Today is Friday, October 30th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, controversy over mail-in ballots in the U.S. elections.
These rejected ballots could mean the difference between winning or losing.
Also ahead, schools are set to reopen in France despite a record COVID-19 surge.
Children from the age of 6 upwards will have to wear a mask. There will be strict social distancing.
Plus, how Malaysians are helping each other get through the pandemic. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S., where there are 4 days to go until voting finishes in nationwide elections. With the campaigns entering their final weekends, presidential candidates Donald Trump and Joe Biden are ramping up efforts to turn out their voters. AP's Sagar Meghani reports.
It'll be Joe Biden's busiest day on the trail yet. He has stops in Wisconsin and Iowa, both of which voted for President Trump in 2016, and Minnesota, which Hillary Clinton won and has long been a solidly blue state. But it's where the president's making a push, and he will appear there as well today. Despite the Midwestern focus, Biden figures the race could be decided in the South.
If Florida goes blue, it's over. It's over.
He was in Florida yesterday, as was the president, who also has stops today in Michigan and Wisconsin. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Over 80 million Americans have already cast their ballots in the election. Many of these voters did so by mailing their ballots in, but there is intense last-minute legal wrangling over how and when to count those ballots. And that could determine who is the next president of the United States. For more, I spoke to VOA Justice correspondent Masood Farivar. Masood, can you first give us some context for this issue of the mail-in ballots?
This has been the most litigated election cycle in U.S. history. There have been something like 300-plus lawsuits filed by Republican and Democratic lawyers during the pandemic, a number of other lawsuits filed by voting rights advocates and election integrity advocates. Broadly speaking, the Democrats want to make it easier for voters to vote by mail by easing certain restrictions, such as the requirement that all mail-in ballots must arrive by election day, or that signatures on ballots must match official records. On the Republican side, their lawsuits have opposed these efforts for a variety of reasons, primarily because they believe easing voting procedures could lead to fraud.
And a number of these cases center on whether states can count votes that were mailed before Election Day but arrive after Election Day. Can you explain those cases?
This week, we had 4 separate rulings in 4 separate cases involving North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, all battleground states with the exception of Minnesota. In the case of Pennsylvania and North Carolina, the Supreme Court basically ruled that ballots can arrive several days after the election. In the case of Wisconsin, we had a different ruling, kind of the opposite. The justices ruled against extending the ballot receipt deadline by 6 days and said that all ballots must arrive by election day or they will not be counted. Interesting what happened in Minnesota. An appeals court last night ruled that ballots that arrive after election day should be segregated or separated from ballots that arrive on election day. I mean, the bottom line is that in Minnesota and in Wisconsin, voters essentially have run out of time to mail in their ballots. Officials in those 2 states are urging voters not to mail their ballots and to use other options. In North Carolina and Pennsylvania, they can still mail in their ballots, hoping that the Postal Service will deliver them on time.
And what impact could some of these decisions have on the election?
Well, that's a very good question. It could potentially turn into a major post-election litigation issue. So ballots that arrive after election day in a lot of cases will be separated from the rest of the ballots in case there's litigation, in case one party or the other challenge their validity. And if the races are close in those states, they could potentially turn the needle.
There's another issue of lots of mail-in ballots that are arriving, but they're being rejected. Can you explain that?
So that's not an entirely new phenomenon. In every election cycle, absentee ballots get thrown out for one reason or another, mostly because they arrive late or someone forgot to sign their ballots. But this year, just because of the sheer volume of voting by mail, a large number of ballots are being tossed out. I talked to a couple of researchers who got their hands on data from North Carolina and Florida, two battleground states that are crucial to determining the winner of the election. In North Carolina, they found that something like 10,000 ballots have been flagged for possible rejection. In Florida, the number is about 15,000. Now, if the results are close in those states, these rejected ballots could mean the difference between winning or losing.
And do these rejections happen pretty much equally, or are they affecting some groups more than others?
Kind of historically, minority voters, Hispanic voters, Black voters have been disproportionately affected by this. For example, in North Carolina, Black voters are three times more likely than white voters to have their ballots rejected. Another category of voters who have their ballots disproportionately rejected is new voters. And in this election, we have millions of people who are voting for the first time. But I want to be careful and not to overstate the extent of this problem. In a number of states, voters are given an opportunity to correct the mistakes on their ballots. Some states actually require election officials to notify voters who have had their ballots rejected so they can correct them. And at this point, with just 4 days left to the election, officials are basically urging voters to stop mailing their ballots. Those who have had their ballots rejected have other options. They can wait until election day, Tuesday, and vote in person. In some states, they still have a couple of days to vote early, and in others, they can drop their ballots at ballot collection boxes.
That was VOA Justice correspondent Masoud Farivar. A strong earthquake in the Aegean Sea has shaken Turkey and Greece, with tremors felt in both Istanbul and Athens. Seismological agencies put the magnitude of the quake between 6.6 and 7.0 on the Richter scale. Turkey's interior minister reports that at least six buildings in western Izmir province were destroyed, the AP reports. The quake was also felt across the eastern Greek islands, with some residents fleeing their homes and rockfalls reported. Reuters reports that Turkish officials have confirmed at least four deaths and more than 100 injured from the earthquake. Thousands of protesters in cities around the world have gathered in support of Poles who have taken to the streets after a court ruling further limited the country's restrictive abortion laws. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
Standing in solidarity with their Polish sisters on Wednesday, hundreds of pro-choice demonstrators gather outside the Polish embassy in Stockholm, Sweden. Revolution. Chanting, "Revolution is a woman," they're one of several rallies around the globe this past week, angry about a top Polish court's decision to ban nearly all abortions in the predominantly Catholic nation. There have been similar scenes in London, Oslo, Berlin, Brussels, and Chicago. After the court ruling goes into effect, abortions due to fetal abnormalities, which make up the vast majority of legal terminations in Poland, will be banned. The procedure will only be permitted in cases of rape, incest, or when the mother's health is at risk.
We show that we do not agree with what's happening in Poland and we want changes. Revolution is a woman.
Since the ruling was announced 8 days ago, Poland has been rocked by huge demonstrations and nationwide strikes, most of them peaceful. Protesters blame the ruling Law and Justice Party for the court's decision, as well as a powerful Catholic Church. On Thursday, Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki made a direct appeal to the women's rights activists. He urged them to halt their demonstrations for the sake of public health. Coronavirus infections have tripled in Poland in under a month.
Ideological disputes are for sure very important and we have to have them, but let's make it in a way so that we do not create the additional danger of death, especially to the elderly, to our mothers and fathers. That's my appeal.
More protests are planned across Poland later this week, including a mass gathering in Warsaw on Friday.
That was Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. This is VOA. A new suspect is in custody Friday in the investigation into yesterday's attack in a French church that killed three people. The alleged perpetrator from Tunisia was shot and is in hospital. The new suspect is a 47-year-old man believed to have been in contact with the attacker the night before the attack, the judicial officials said, the AP reports. Tunisian anti-terror authorities also opened an investigation Friday into an online claim of responsibility by a person who said the attack was staged by a previously unknown Tunisian extremist group. New Zealanders have voted in favor of legalizing euthanasia for the terminally ill in a binding referendum, but in preliminary results, they were rejecting a measure to legalize marijuana. The AP reports that with about 83% of votes counted, New Zealanders endorsed the euthanasia measure with 65% voting in favor. The no vote on marijuana was closer, with 53% voting against legalizing it. That left open a slight chance the measure could still pass once all special votes are counted next week, although it would require a huge swing. Lawmakers in the U.S. city of Philadelphia have voted to block police from using tear gas, rubber bullets, or pepper spray on peaceful protesters. The vote follows days of at-times violent protests against the police killing of 27-year-old black man Walter Wallace Jr. on Monday. The Wallace family and their lawyer viewed police body cam footage Thursday of the shooting and said it shows officers panicking and shooting a mentally ill man, the AP reports. In a news conference Wednesday, the city's police commissioner, Danielle Outlaw, said her department lacks a team to handle mental health crisis calls. Reuters reports the local police union president has defended the officers responsible, saying they were working under stress and that Wallace had a knife. Listening to International Edition on the Voice of America, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. The World Health Organization says worldwide COVID-19 cases are at 44.5 million, with nearly 1.8 million deaths. In the U.S., the number of infections hit a new daily record of more than 90,000 Thursday. The White House Coronavirus Task Force warns that much of the country is in the grips of a, quote, unrelenting, end quote, surge in COVID-19 cases, and urged tough countermeasures. Another daily record was set in Russia, where new cases surged to over 18,000 on Friday, taking the national total to about 1.6 million infections. In France, schools are set to reopen Monday following a holiday, but the reopening comes amid a surge in COVID-19 cases in the country, which is at the center of a second wave of infections affecting much of the European Union. The return to schools in France also comes as the country begins a fresh lockdown. For more, I reached out to journalist Catherine Field in Paris. Catherine, what will happen in French schools on Monday?
On Monday morning, 61,000 schools across France will be open. 12 million children will go back to school. How this will happen is that children from the age of six upwards will have to wear a mask. That's a new rule. Up until now, it had only been children aged from 11 onwards. There will be strict social distancing. That will mean children will have to arrive at school at different times. Children will have their play breaks at different times. Plus, sanitary conditions will be much stricter. What the government is hoping is twofold. One, that it means children go back to school and are not staying at home. And secondly, it means that this will be a focus of their day. They won't be sitting at home and there won't be the risk that children will fall out of the school, the education system completely.
And of course, this comes right in the middle of a major surge in cases in France. Are there any concerns that the reopening of schools could contribute to that?
If you look at the figures, there are 27 out of that 61,000 schools across France closed because there have been outbreaks of COVID within the school population. So it does seem as though the risk is somewhat smaller for children of that age. Overall, there does seem to be an acceptance that this is some way forward. There is restrictions on freedom of movement in France at the moment. People are having to work from home. So the government is very much selling it as this will make it easier for you to work from home because you won't be dealing with your children at the same time. On top of that, there is certainly this question of the social consequences of having so many generations enclosed in one place in a home for 24 hours of a day. And we've seen that there have been cases where, you know, violence within families has happened. So it's seen that this could well be a safe way to allow families to let off steam, to have some sort of contact with the outside world.
And what about other countries in Europe? How are they handling schools amid this surge?
Well, in neighboring Germany, which of course was quite successful in reducing the number of coronavirus cases earlier this year, they are now seeing the numbers increase, and they are having to impose restrictions on bars and restaurants and cultural activities. But they too are keeping kindergartens and schools open. They feel they need to do that. Also, same situation in Ireland. Schools are being kept open. There's this real feeling that this is part of the community that needs to be done, because it is a generation that risks being left behind.
That was journalist Catherine Fields in Paris. India's months-long COVID-19 shutdown of schools has inspired new ways to teach students who do not have internet access to online classes. Anjana Pasrika visited the poor district of Nuh in northern India's Haryana state to see how thousands of students are being taught.
When the bell rings from a loudspeaker mounted on a van to announce the start of classes in Kanvarsika village, students settle down for lessons inside homes and in courtyards. Following a customary prayer, a teacher presents a chemistry class using a microphone from the street. The classes ensure that these students do not fall behind after missing months of school because of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Our study is very good.
Ninth grade student Sania Ahmed says the classes help her keep pace with studies. Taking lessons at home also makes her feel safe from coronavirus. Nuh district in northern India has found creative ways to teach students. From classes held in scores of village squares under an initiative called Community Schools, to the van that beams lessons into homes. Local volunteers and teachers conduct the classes that now reach 7,000 students in scores of villages. The initiative was launched after authorities found that most students in the low-income district could not log on to online classes because they did not have access to computers or smartphones.
Digital education hamare yahan safal nahi ho payi hai.
Primary school teacher Jamshed Khan, who teaches in Rigar village, explains that digital education could not work in the district because most families here are large and usually have only one phone. Eighth grade student Saista comes from such a family. She says there are three brothers and sisters in her family, but only her brother gets the phone, so she could not study. That is why these classes really help her. In Rigar, the community classes have expanded from 5 to 15.
71.
Younger students learn numbers and writing, while older students are taught English and math during two-hour sessions. In the open space, they sit at a distance in keeping with COVID-19 protocols. The local volunteers called education ambassadors who conduct the two-hour sessions range from teachers to postgraduates, such as Khushi Mohammed. Mohammed says he joined the initiative after losing his job in a private school. The classes help him and the children, who are now covering their syllabus. For many ambitious students, these classes are crucial. An eighth grade student, Faizan Khan, says his test scores will determine whether he can pursue science courses. Khan says he wants to become a doctor, and the classes are giving him confidence that he will get good grades when schools reopen. Like many others, though, he says he misses the conventional school day. The school was lively, according to Khan. While he goes home now after 2 hours, earlier, he only returned around 3 o'clock, then went to the mosque. He says he misses those days. With schools still closed, though, the community school initiative is helping ensure that the pandemic does not cost thousands of students a year of school. Anjana Pusricha for VOA News, Rigar, India.
Volunteers in Malaysia are stepping up to help a remote area of the country that has been especially hard hit by the coronavirus. Dave Grunebaum reports from Shah Alam, Malaysia.
At a storage site, volunteers tape and stack box after box of donated food and personal protective equipment, or PPE, from face shields to sardines. It is being sent from Malaysia's biggest metropolitan area to one of its most remote, Semporna, which has seen a surge in COVID-19 cases in recent weeks. Thousands of people are under lockdown. Some live in communities that can only be reached by boat. William Chia is a co-founder of a social enterprise called Canberra Kitchen that organized the donation drive.
You do not need to be a very big person to have a very big impact. If everybody comes together, the unity in it involved, in people coming in to help each other out, you create a lot of effect.
Zach Ho and his wife Ivy dropped off some powdered milk formula.
We feel like every contribution helps, so we're just trying to do it. Even though it's a very small amount, we hope that it helps the situations in Semporna.
Volunteer Tan Mei Ling is a piano teacher whose music school is currently closed due to the pandemic. She helps stack and organize boxes of PPE.
So I thought I would just come and help, and since I was free, I couldn't teach, so I just came to help, and it feels good.
Altogether, more than 4 tons of aid was donated. The supplies were flown to the airport nearest to Semporna before being distributed by government agencies and non-government organizations. For VOA, I'm Dave Grunebaum in Shah Alam, Malaysia.
That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Tune in on Monday, where Steve Miller will be back hosting. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Sickle cell disease is an inherited condition that, if left untreated, kills 80% of children born with it before they reach their 5th birthday. In sub-Saharan Africa, where 75% of cases occur, every year about 300,000 infants are born with the disease. Taking advantage of decades of experience that comes from battling sickle cell disease among its own population of African Americans, the United States is partnering with countries in sub-Saharan Africa that have the largest number of people suffering from the disease. There are a couple of approaches we can use, said Brett Gerois, a pediatric doctor and admiral in the United States Public Health Service, who currently serves as the Assistant Secretary for Health at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
We could mitigate the effects of the disease. We could treat people like we treat all other conditions. And we could do that very simply. If we give penicillin and vaccines, we know we can get children who die before age 5 up into their 20s with nothing else, probably into their 30s or 40s. If we do hydroxyurea, very, very cheap, and some pain control and simple measures, there's no reason that people can't live to their 40s and 50s.
Now we can also take advantage of treatments that deal with a genetic defect in the blood. That's important because a human being replaces his or her red blood cells every 90 days.
You could correct the gene defect in the bone marrow, and all of a sudden people with sickle cell will start pumping out normal cells. That is not science fiction. That's being done in clinical trials right here in the United States, and it has a potential for being scalable to hundreds of thousands or millions of people.
Admiral Gerois believes that within 10 years, we could see relatively inexpensive, accessible treatment that would enable people with sickle cell disease everywhere to lead normal lives. There has never been a time in history that there's been so much activity and excitement about helping people with sickle cell disease, he said. There's never been this opportunity, and we want to seize it. And the time is really right. Just think about that. 9 million children by 2050 that we can save, have them happy, safe, productive lives for their countries, for them to raise families on their own.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is Lori London. Tune tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts. Every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source.